Why, hello. Hope you all had a wonderful feast. I had an interesting last 2 or 3 weeks, and I talked a little bit about it at Atonement, but I thought it was interesting. So we went to Puerto Vallarta, Mexico, which I've never been to Mexico before, and so we go there, and I had no idea what to expect or anything, and it was hot, and it was really hot, which is funny because we're from Texas, and we're like, oh, heat's not that big a deal, and so it kind of put me in a bad mood because I wanted it to be very refreshing and everything like that, and then we get into our room, and I was thinking, oh, well, I'll go to the room, we'll turn the air conditioning down, and we'll do this, that, and be nice and comfortable. And the air conditioner unit wasn't working very well. So it was 86 degrees, and I had to Google that because it was in Celsius, and I had no idea how to change it to Fahrenheit. So I had no idea what I was going to go complain about because I had no idea exactly how hot it was. And Victoria's like, well, let's just relax, and let's just, you know, put it in God's hands. It'll be okay. And so I prayed about it, and nothing happened. You know, it didn't change. So then I call, and they send somebody up, and I don't know. They were shooting some gun at this thing, and they're like, yep, should be good. And it wasn't. So we just stayed in that room that night, and it was like 81 degrees. That's about the coolest that it got, and we made it through. And anyways, it was just interesting. Because the feast kind of goes on, and we did actually end up having a really, really good feast, and we had some awesome messages, and we got to know some people, and it was phenomenal. But as things were kind of going, I kept getting tested, because then on the way home, and one of the things that I pray about a lot is I ask for patience, because I'm not a patient person. I try to leave things in God's hands, but then I think it's just my nature. I think it's the job that I have and just the type of person. I like to control things. And so we get to the airport and we get into the U.S., into Houston, and we have to make a connecting flight. And we paid extra money so that we could board and be in like Southwest. We were A1 through 6. So we were to be the first on the plane. Everybody's luggage comes through except for mine. And so I'm like, seriously, what are you doing? Like, I'm praying about it and everything. But it's like, I'm praying and I'm saying, just hurry up and answer my prayer in my time. Like, I wanted it right then. And so we get home and everything works out. I made the flight and all of this, that, and the other. We've had these things, you know, we were trying to build a house and some different things. And that didn't work out just yet and all of these things. So Victoria's like, well, have you been praying and like really, you were listening to the Bible on your way to work. You're not going into work as much now. Have you? And I'm like, okay, I'll listen to the Bible on the way to work. But I'm just being very candid with you guys. I was frustrated. I really was. And I was like, I don't know that you're actually listening to me and that you actually hear my prayers. And it's like, I prayed about things and everything, but I didn't feel like I was getting the answers that I wanted or in the time that I wanted. And so Monday morning rolls around and I'm like, well, I'll just listen to the Bible on the way into work. And this was last Monday. And so I go and I look, and I had been going through on Audible and stepping through all the different chapters of the Bible, because I've never read the Bible all the way through just like all at once. So I had gone through, well, somehow I was in Matthew or Mark, and I was like, nah, I don't think that's right. I'll go back to Judges. That sounds about right. I was like, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, Joshua. Yeah, that sounds about 7 chapters or books of the Bible I've probably gone through. But then I was like, well, Judges, that's going to be kind of boring. It's just these judges and whatever. So I start listening to it, and I'm like, wow, it was very eye-opening. Because basically, and that's what we're going to talk about, basically, Judges is all about idolatry. And we think, how could these Israelites be so stupid to just continually be saved and then turn to idols, and then saved and then turn to idols, and saved and back and forth? And I go, whoa, well, hey, Chris, how could you be so stupid to see all the blessings that God gives you and have access to God's Holy Spirit and to this plan and to this marvelous Feast of Tabernacles where you get to go to a beautiful country, and yet you're still angry about this or that, or you can't be patient, and it's like this vicious cycle. And so that's what I want to talk about today, is breaking the idolatry cycle. That's the title that I came up with. In reading through Judges, we're not going to go through all of Judges, but we're going to focus on Judges 2, 6 through 3, 6. But I wanted to listen to something, and so like I said, I wasn't quite sure. So it's really, Judges is actually kind of depressing. It's also one of the most hopeful books in the Bible. One of the questions that we're forced to ask when we read this book is, how could the people of Israel be so blinded, be so stupid is really the only word that I can think of. And that may seem harsh, but it's really what comes to mind. They had everything going for them. They had seen God act. God kept on raising up new leaders for them. He kept bailing them out, and yet they kept blowing it. And they didn't just make small mistakes either. They kept turning to idols, and they really absolutely were blowing it. A couple of definitions as we move through this. Idolatry is the worship of idols, and which another definition is extreme admiration, love, or reverence for something or someone. But idols is also defined as an image or a representation of God as an object of worship. So the passages that I wanted to go through, Judges 2:6 through 3:6, these passages lay out a pattern for the rest of the book. It's a cycle that repeats itself over and over. It's not so much a cycle as a downward spiral. They just spiraled out of control. Judges shows that Israel, they just spiraled further and further away from God and into trouble. The reason that this was so, like, profound for me is because that really just threw me off, because this is a split and it says that I have 5 minutes left. We're going to have to go fast. But the reason that it hit me so hard is I felt like that was me. I was just kind of going down this spiral, kind of out of control. And what we're going to look at today, it forms a template for the book of Judges. We're going to see as well that the heart of this downward spiral, like what is it? It's an issue that's much more than just a problem for us. It's much more than just what they went through. We go through it as well today. So I'd like to ask just a few questions, and they're in no particular order, but we're going to step through them. What is a downward spiral? What's at the heart of a downward spiral? How do we break a downward spiral? And what is this cycle or downward spiral consist of? So the downward spiral that we're reading about happens over and over in Judges. In fact, I calculated it's at least 6 times. And here's how it works. So let's pick it up here in verse 6. And when Joshua had dismissed the people, the children of Israel went each to his own inheritance to possess the land. So the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua, who had seen all the great works of the Lord, which he had done for Israel. Now Joshua, the son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died when he was 110. And they buried him within the border of his inheritance. Verse 10, when all that generation had been gathered to their fathers, another generation arose after them who did not know the Lord nor the work which he had done for Israel. So really the downward spiral kind of starts here in verse 11. Continually the people of Israel fell into apostasy, which is they just stopped worshiping God. Then the children of Israel did evil, verse 11, in the sight of the Lord and served the Baals, and they forsook the Lord of their God, their fathers, who had brought them out of the land of Egypt. And they followed other gods among the gods of the people who were all around them, and they bowed down to them, and they provoked the Lord to anger. They forsook the Lord and served Baal and Ashtoreths. And I'll talk about that a little bit. She's just the god of fertility. So the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord. They forsook the Lord and they would basically just step away. They followed and worshiped various gods of the people around them. They rejected the Lord. They may have still worshiped him in some form or fashion, but it clearly says they stopped worshiping God. But as we read, they began worshiping Baal, the Canaanite storm god, and then Ashtoreths, who is the goddess of fertility. As a response to this sin and to this idolatry, then God let them fall into the hands of their enemies. Verse 14, and the anger of the Lord was hot against Israel, so he delivered them into the hands of plunderers who deployed them, and he sold them into the hands of their enemies all around, so they could no longer stand before their enemies. So as a response to this sin and idolatry, God let them fall into the hands of their enemies. In his anger against Israel, he gave them over to raiders who plundered them. He sold them into the hand of the enemies all around him. And then, of course, what happens? Let's skip down to verse 18. The Lord relented because the people were groaning. The Lord relented because they're groaning under those who oppressed and afflicted them. In response, God raised up judges. These were these leaders who would rescue them from their oppression. He gives them a savior. Verse 18. And when the Lord raised up judges for them, the Lord was with the judge and delivered them out of the hand of their enemies all the days of the judge. For the Lord was moved to pity by their groaning because of those who oppressed them and harassed them. So God would raise up these judges because he felt bad for them, and he would put them into power, and they would do well while that judge was there. But it never lasted. Verse 19, and it came to pass when the judge was dead, they reverted and behaved more corruptly than their fathers by following other gods to serve them and bow down to them. They did not cease from their own doings nor from their stubborn way. So they kept this spiral going, and things kept getting worse and worse. Rebellion, oppression, a cry for help, new leadership, and right back to rebellion again. You read this and you think, I read it and I think, how could they do this? How could they be so blind, so stupid to get caught up in this pattern like this that just repeats itself over and over with such tragic results? Why couldn't they break out of this pattern? If we're honest, we have to admit, we get caught in these cycles. We do. They couldn't break themselves out of this downward spiral, and neither can we sometimes. The reason is that there's a problem at the heart of this cycle, and it still affects us today. It's a problem that pulls us downward as well. So what is at the heart of a downward spiral, and how do we get caught in one of these? Well, if you look carefully, you'll see that at the heart of a downward spiral was the irresistible pull of idols. No matter how God delivered them, they couldn't resist the allure of idolatry. And neither can we. Their problem in one word was this: idolatry. I mean, that's what it's summed up as. As long as our hearts can't resist the pull of idols, we'll never break free from the downward spiral of idolatry. We won't. And I know, I guarantee, at least somebody in this audience is thinking, I do not worship idols. Because I was thinking, I don't bow down to any idols. As I was listening to this and I was thinking about it, I was like, I don't bow down to any idols. I never have. I never would. I've never worshiped an idol in my life. I wish it was that easy. I really do. I would like to say that it's that easy. We are idolatrous today. In fact, idolatry is the sin behind all sins, the problem behind all problems. Now, we don't have Baal and Ashtoreth anymore. We don't worship carvings and images that, that we set up in our houses. But idols aren't just images. They aren't just carvings. An idol is anything we worship when we add to what God is as a requirement to be happy. An idol, let me say that again, it's anything we worship, anything we add to God as a requirement for us to be happy. We do have idols today. If you think about it, we really do. In preparing for this message, I came across an excerpt from a gentleman, his name is Richard Kias. He wrote, "An idol is something within creation that is inflated to function as God. All sorts of things are potential idols, depending only on our attitude and our actions towards them. Idolatry may not involve explicit denial of God's existence or character. It may well come in the form of an overattachment to something that is, in itself, perfectly good. An idol can be a physical object, a property, a person, an activity, a role, an institution, a hope, an image, an idea, a pleasure, a hero, anything that can substitute for God. Whenever we value something more than God, we are committing the sin of idolatry." I don't know if you've thought about it that way. I had not. Until I really started digging in and putting this together, I had never thought that I was somebody who committed idolatry. An idol is a substitute of God. That basically something that we love and worship more than we do the true God. Turn to Colossians 3. Colossians 3 and verse 5. I always love it when you download the update to an app and then it completely changes the app and they're like, "Oh, it's so much more functional," but it's not. "So put to death the sinful earthly things lurking within you. Have nothing to do with sexual immorality, impurity, lust, and evil desires. Don't be greedy, for a greedy person is an idolater, worshiping the things of this world." This is why the Apostle Paul wrote that you don't need an actual physical idol to be an idolater. If you look at anything for satisfaction, and if you have to have it, then you're an idolater. In Colossians 3, verse 5, Paul writes what we just read about, and we think about the happiness and the things that we have to, you know, like the things that we require, and we begin to kind of move away from God. Greed is idolatry. It's the sin behind all sin. It's the chief vice, wanting more. It's the condition of our hearts that isn't happy with what we have, that's always looking for more, even for good things, happiness and satisfaction. Augustine said that this is the essence of sin, inordinate, unusually or disproportionately large desire or making good things ultimate things. Whenever we do this, we're committing idolatry. Further study, I came across something interesting. John Calvin in the Institute of Christian Religion said that our hearts are idol factories. It's like our heart operates 24/7, forging idols at will. The problem with the judges is that they could get rid of all of the idols. They could say, "Let's take this out. We don't need this." But they couldn't do anything about the idols in people's hearts. And that's what I'm talking about today. The minute we take our eyes off God, our heart begins to manufacture idols for us to worship. Because we have to give our hearts to something. We have to give our hearts to something. Right now, you may not be giving your heart to something. Maybe you're focused on God, and that is awesome. But we are always tempted to give our hearts to someone or something else other than God. Even a good thing, a person, a career, a job. Right now you're being tempted by the same sin that these people were powerless to resist, the sin of idolatry. You can turn to Isaiah 44, 9 through 20. This is an interesting parable. The parable of the blacksmith, and the carpenter. All those who make idol, verse 9, are worthless, and the gods they prize so highly are useless. Those who worship these gods are blind and ignorant, and they will be disgraced. It does no good to make a metal image to worship as a god. Everyone who worships it will be humiliated. The people who make idols are human beings and nothing more. Let them come and stand trial. They will be terrified and will suffer disgrace. The metal worker takes a piece of metal and works it over a fire. His strong arm swings a hammer to pound the metal into shape. As he works, he gets hungry, thirsty, and tired. The carpenter measures the wood. He outlines a figure with chalk, carves it out with his tools, and makes it into the form of a man, a handsome human figure to be placed in his house. He might cut down cedars to use, or choose oak or cypress wood from the forest, or he might plant a laurel tree and wait for the rain to make it grow. A person uses part of a tree for fuel and part of it for making an idol. With one part, he builds a fire to warm himself and bake bread. And with the other part, he makes a god and he worships it. With some of the wood, he makes a fire. He roasts meat, eats it, and is satisfied. He warms himself and says, "How nice and warm. What a beautiful fire." The rest of the wood, he makes an idol into it. And then he bows down and he worships it. He prays to it and he says, "You are my God. Save me." Such people... I'm reading this translation, which is a Good News translation, and I really liked it because it says, such people are too stupid to know what they are doing. They close their eyes and their minds to the truth. The makers of idol hasn't the wit or the sense to say, some of the wood I burned up, I baked some bread for the coals, and I roasted meat and I ate it. And the rest of the wood I made into an idol. Here I am, bowing down to a block of wood. It makes as much sense as eating ashes. His foolish ideas have so misled him that he is beyond help. He won't admit to himself that the idol he holds in his hand is not a god at all. Our greatest danger isn't that you'll stop worshiping God. It isn't that we'll stop worshiping God and become an atheist. That's not our greatest danger. Our greatest danger is that we will combine the worship of God and the worship of idols, and we won't even know we're doing it. That's the real danger that we face. And when we do this, and we all do it, it is ultimately unsatisfying. Verse 17 of Judges says, "Yet they would not listen to their judge, but prostituted themselves out to other gods and worshiped them." The problem with idolatry is that it's a lot like prostitution. Prostitutes give themselves away without getting any pleasure or love in return. When we serve idols, we enter into a relationship in which we give ourselves away. We give ourselves away and we get very little in return. We become completely vulnerable, but become little more than slaves. There's another writing by Cornelius, and it says, All idolatry is not only treacherous, but also futile. Human desire, deep and restless and seemingly unfulfillable, keeps stuffing itself with finite goods, but these cannot satisfy. If we try to fill our hearts with anything besides the God of this universe, we find that we are overfed but undernourished. And we find that day by day and week by week and year by year, we're thinking down to a mere outline of a human being. Sin is really like continually running from God to a far country and looking for substitutes for him and never being satisfied. We are caught in this cycle of idolatry. It's a downward spiral that we're powerless to resist, as we see in Judges. It will destroy us. There are good things in our lives, but those good things can destroy us. Not because there's anything wrong with them, not because of anything innate with them. They'll destroy us because we're tempted to give our heart to our career or to our spouse or to whatever it is that we give our heart to above God. There's nothing wrong with giving your heart and your life to your spouse or working really hard at your job. There is something wrong with that being the ultimate goal, and it's above God. They'll destroy you because you'll be tempted to give your heart to your career or technology or to fitness or to your spouse or to your girlfriend or your boyfriend, your children. Anything that you give your life to more than God will become idolatry and will destroy us. We'll take good things and we make them into ultimate things, and it never satisfies us, and ultimately it will destroy us. So all that to say, well, how do we break it? Like, what do we do? What isn't the solution? That's a good place to start. We can't deal with idolatry by getting rid of all the things that we're tempted to worship as idols. It'd be nice, for instance, if we're tempted by my career and I could just be like, yeah, I quit. I'm not going to go to work anymore. Well, that's not possible. But the reality is, you'll probably have to keep working. I have to. We won't be able to get rid of the idols around us, even if we wanted to. God said in Judges verse 22 that he was going to leave these nations and their idols as a way of testing Israel. We'll never be free of the temptation to give in to idol worship. The solution isn't even for a change in our outward circumstances. That's the beauty of it. It isn't about all the stuff that's around us. It's about what's in us. Verse 16 and 17 of Judges, then the Lord raised up judges who saved them out of the hands of these raiders, yet they would not listen to their judges but prostituted themselves out. And then in verse 18 and 19, whenever the Lord raised them up, he was the judge and saved them out of the hands. But when the judge died, the people would return. So we read all that. The problem isn't changing the outward circumstances. That's why religion, for instance, can't cure idolatry. Religion is simply about trying harder to follow rules, to please God. The problem with religion is that despite our efforts, nothing really changes. If we don't change our heart, nothing really changes. That's why me standing up here yelling and pushing this, you shouldn't have idols, you shouldn't do this, it really would do nothing. Unless what we do is we take away, okay, I need to realize what are the idols in my life and how do I put God above them? How do I never let those idols become more important than God? You can get rid of the idols in your house, your phone, your workout equipment, whatever the case may be. But if you don't get rid of the idols in your heart, you will still have the problem. So the answer is, we need to ask God to not just change our circumstances, but to change our heart. Don't just change our circumstances, change our heart. That probably seems simple, but it's not. There's a lot involved in that. God knew we couldn't break free from the cycle of idolatry ourselves. But God sent the ultimate judge who not only rescues us, but can change our heart as well, if we let him. We have to let him, though. We have to be willing to change. I, a person of control, I like to control everything. I've got to learn to let go. I've got to learn to let go. Ephesians 4, verse 24. Ephesians 4 and verse 24. Put on your new nature, created to be like God, truly righteous and holy. We have to put on a new self, which is created in God's likeness and reveals itself in true life that is upright and holy. I did put together 6 quick little items, because a lot of times I think that, and I'll just buzz through these, but a lot of times I think the things that we do wrong are because of habits. And so I just want to point something out. These are 6 simple steps for breaking a cycle of anything. You could use these for anything you want, any bad habit. Identify cues. You have to identify cues. A cue is something that triggers the habit. A cue can be anything. Maybe stress makes you crave chocolate, or the sound of the alarm triggers you to hit the snooze button. Identify cues helps you understand what puts your habit into motion. The next is disrupt. You have to disrupt the habit. Once you know the cues, you can throw bad habits off track. If the alarm cues you to hit that snooze button, put the alarm across the room to make you get up and go turn it off. 3 is replace. Research shows that replacing a bad behavior with a good one is more effective than stopping the bad one. The new behavior interferes with the old habit and prevents your brain from going into autopilot. Deciding to eat fruit every time your mind thinks cookie substitutes a positive behavior for the negative habit. If you're on the phone too much, replace it with reading the Bible. I mean, that's something I've tried. Keep it simple. Number four, keep it simple. It's usually hard to change a habit because the behavior has become easy and automatic. The opposite is true too. New behaviors can be hard because your brain's basal ganglia, the autopilot part, hasn't taken over this behavior yet. Simplifying new behaviors helps you integrate them into your autopilot routines. Number five is think long term. Habits often form because they satisfy short-term impulses. The way chewing your nails might immediately calm your nerves. Short-term desires often have long-term consequences, like nasty, splintered, chewed-up fingers. I think the Israelites were short-sighted. They lost focus. They let the autopilot take over far too often, and they lost track of the long-term goal. Focusing long-term while trying to change some habits will help us to remember why we're even investing in this effort anyways. And number six is persist. Research has shown that what you've done before is a strong indicator of what you'll do next. This means established habits are hard to break. But the good news is if you keep at it, your new behavior will turn into a habit too. And persistence works. At first, it might be painful to get up at 5 a.m. for that jog, but soon you'll have it down as second nature. We have to remember this. We have a problem. We have a problem. Our problem is one that we can't break out of ourselves. I'm not talking to you. I'm talking to me. I truly am. The above quick tips, sure, they can help, but ultimately, we are idolaters. You can get rid of all the idols you want. But as John Calvin said, your heart will just make more. Satan is not going to stop. He's not going to give up. He won't quit. The problem isn't even the idols. The problem is our heart. The problem is our heart. Change our heart and we change our life. God in his grace has sent a judge to break the cycle of idolatry that only leads to death. He sent his son as that ultimate judge. And he's not only able to set us free, but he can change our hearts as well. We just have to let him.